This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Mandatory minimum sentences, these are laws that set the prison terms for certain crimes that judges cannot lower, even if there are extenuating circumstances. The most common of these laws deals with drug offenses, and they set mandatory minimum sentences for possession of a drug over a certain amount. The judge is not permitted to impose a shorter sentence, even if there are facts that would normally provide a reason for leniency. The judge has got to ignore those factors. The most common examples of mandatory minimum sentences are for federal drug laws for possession of certain amounts of illegal drugs. For example, you get caught with 1 gram of LSD. That means you're going to spend at least 5 years in prison. So how is this working? Is it fair? Is there a better way? Have you been or someone in your family been caught up in a federal minimum sentence or any kind of a minimum sentence guidelines? We'd like to hear from you. The number to call, 614-8980. You can also email your questions and comments to thesource@tpr.org. Go to the comments section on our website at tpr.org. Our guest for this segment of the program is Mark Levin. He's the director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. And later we'll hear from Molly Gill, the Government Affairs Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. But Mark Levin, welcome to The Source.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, Mark, how do you get most people to get concerned, to buy into this argument that we need to fix mandatory minimums?
Well, you know, I think one of the things is for people to think about whether they have more confidence and trust in themselves and other citizens that are put on juries as well as judges, whether they have more confidence in them or more confidence in politicians, because essentially mandatory minimums take discretion away from judges and juries who are, of course, privy to the specific facts of the case and the background of the individual and the concerns of the victim and so forth, and mandatory minimums take the discretion from those judges and juries and put it in the hands of politicians who obviously are only in a position to kind of make a one-size-fits-all law for all cases, regardless of the facts. So I think that given that it's pretty clear to me that the average member of the public has greater confidence in judges and juries than in politicians and Congress, that it's not surprising, actually, that we have seen quite a bit of reform of mandatory minimum laws over the last several years.
Now, I've been in courtrooms and seen federal judges. They deal with a drug crime. They basically pull out a menu and they go right down the line. Okay, you get caught with X amount of cocaine. This means you got to go at least this amount of time to the federal penitentiary.
Well, yes, and of course, there has been a U.S. Supreme Court ruling which has said that it's a Booker decision that the federal guidelines that were once the federal sentencing guidelines that were once strictly mandatory, now federal judges do have some wiggle room, but of course, some federal judges kind of still view it as mandatory and for whatever reason, and just kind of out of habit, perhaps. So, and then of course, there's states like Florida that still have very severe mandatory minimums for minor drug offenses. So, I remember, in fact, when Rush Limbaugh was caught with painkillers in Florida, that if he had actually been convicted, he could have been subject to a 25-year mandatory minimum, and those policies are still in place. I think that incident was probably 4 or 5 years ago. But, you know, the reality is that these policies need to be reexamined. I think that from a conservative perspective, which is where we come from with Right on Crime, it's really encouraging that more and more conservative leaders and thinkers are saying, look, this isn't conservative to override judges and juries and to kind of try to make make square pegs fit into a round hole, that what we need to do is really say, look, there should be a range of punishment based on is the person a first-time offender or not? Are they amenable to rehabilitation? What is their attitude towards the judicial process? What are the desires of the victim? You know, one of the real misconceptions is that victims always want the most severe sentence. We've often seen, in property offenses in particular, surveys of victims showing they most want restitution. And, of course, if you send somebody who stole from you you to jail, they're generally going to be unlikely to pay and unable to pay any restitution, whereas other types of sentences where they actually have to hold a job and pay restitution through probation and so forth result in far greater collection of restitution. And so the mandatory minimum is one of the overlooked problems with them, is they actually totally disregard what sentence the victim may want in a particular case.
To the idea that you brought up, that doing away with mandatory minimums is something that conservatives are embracing. Even George Will had written about it recently, calling it a libertarian idea that to give judges more authority in this area.
No, that's absolutely true. And I mean, I think that that we're going to continue to see a move towards abolishing mandatory minimums, particularly for nonviolent offenses.
Let me ask you about that. Particularly in drug crimes, people have said that mandatory minimums have a racial component to them, that people who are involved in drug crimes, nonviolent drug crimes, may have get the really harsh mandatory minimums, but people who are involved in white collar crimes don't.
Well, you know, there are certainly under the federal sentencing guidelines, I think there are mandatory minimums for certain white collar crimes. And, you know, I don't know if he was covered by a mandatory minimum, but Bernard Madoff got 130 years in prison, so people can go away for a long time for really atrocious white-collar crimes. But I think one of the areas where your question has arisen is in regard to the crack powder disparity. Now, there was a reform bill, which actually Senator Cornyn was one of the key supporters of, that passed a couple years ago in Congress, that did narrow that disparity, but it still is a fairly large disparity between powder and crack. And of course, you know, I think there is some argument that for, you know, the same amount of crack is perhaps more destructive, you know, as far as more powerful, but I think the disparity probably exceeds that. So of course, given the mandatory minimums both federally and in Florida and other states can will attach to both crack and powder cocaine, that the disparity between those certainly and the composition of the people that tend to be charged with those that it could certainly result in some variations along different demographic groups. But you know, I think the main thing is philosophically, regardless of you know, how many people of different demographic groups are subject to mandatory minimums, the reality is that that philosophically they do rob the judges and juries of the basically the most basic thing, which is make the sentence fit the crime. And the crime isn't just the offense someone committed. It's their prior record. It's looking at using risk and needs assessment to determine if someone can be rehabilitated, and if so, what programs and course of treatment, if they have a drug addiction or a mental health issue,
Mark,
can result in that rehabilitation.
Mark Levin, he joins us. He's the director of the Center for Effective Justice at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. We're talking about the mandatory minimum sentences and their calls to reform that in our criminal justice system. We've got to let Mark go. We appreciate you joining us on The Source. We're going to be right back. We're going to continue this conversation. The number to call, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX.
Over the past 20 years, our nation's laws with respect to cocaine sentencing have resulted in a penal system unjust, racially disparate, and arguably in violation of the Constitution's Equal Protection Clause. Most of us, even including the administration, agree that the current system is unfair and that change is needed. Now, what change? Crack cocaine offenders, almost all of whom are racial minorities, receive sentences of up to 8 times longer than those convicted for the same amount of cocaine in powder form. That's well understood. And so this is the first time.
And that's audio from Michigan Congressman John Conyers as he's talking about the Fair Sentencing Act in 2010. And it was about trying to reform mandatory minimum sentencing for these drug laws. And that's what we're talking about, not just about drug laws, but about all laws. You know, why do we have mandatory minimum sentences at all? We invite you to join the conversation. The number is 614-8980. If it's impacted you or your family member, if you're a defense attorney, a prosecutor, you've got some expertise on this issue, call in, tell us what you think. Now, joining the conversation now, Molly Gill is the Government Affairs Counsel for the Families Against Mandatory Minimums, or FAM. And Molly, welcome to The Source.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So, Molly, how did we get here? Why do we even have mandatory minimum sentences? Why were they passed by legislators?
Well, we've always had them on the books. The earliest, if you're curious, dates back to 1790, and it is a life sentence for piracy on the high seas. And if you think back to 1790, what was the problem back then? Piracy on the high seas was a big problem in early America. And that's a textbook example of how we get these mandatory minimum sentences. Congress sees a problem, hears about a problem, they feel this political pressure to act, and the easiest and fastest solution is let's slap a mandatory minimum prison sentence on it, and that will solve the problem. And, of course, it doesn't solve the problem. And so over the years, historically, we now have over 190 mandatory minimums in the federal criminal code. And if you look at the dates that they were passed, they almost always line up with some kind of hot-button, high-profile criminal incident of the time. So the crack and powder cocaine laws that you've been talking about, those mandatory minimums were created in the 1980s at the height of a scare about crack cocaine. It was a new drug. It was on the streets. People were very worried and afraid of it. And so Congress thought, well, the solution is mandatory sentences. And usually these laws are passed very quickly with very little research or empirical study. And so we don't know that they're actually going to give us the solution we want, which is less drug usage. And in fact, history has shown that they haven't reduced drug usage. They haven't reduced the importation of drugs into this country. We still have a drug consumption problem in this country, and mandatory minimum sentences have succeeded at nothing but locking up tens of thousands of people at enormous cost to taxpayers.
Three strikes laws are another form of mandatory minimum sentencing. Under these laws, you will face a specific, a minimum sentence if you're convicted of a third felony under federal law. This could be prison without parole if it's your third felony, with at least one previous felony where it was a violent crime. So, what do we know about these three strikes laws? I mean, do they work?
They definitely don't. And in fact, these are, I think, probably the most famous mandatory minimums and the most infamous mandatory minimums that can result in incredibly unjust outcomes. I'm reminded of a case of a man from Iowa who was a longtime drug addict. He sold methamphetamine, which is a very popular drug in Iowa and lots of other places, and wasn't a huge, wasn't making a ton of money off of it, wasn't violent, was just mainly using the money to feed his own addiction. And he racked up three state-level convictions for these crimes, and he got probation all three times. And then he did it a fourth time, and they sent his case up to the federal system, and he got convicted, and he got a mandatory minimum life without parole sentence. This is a man who had never set foot in jail before a day in his life. And while he was in federal prison, he sobered up and became a stand-up person, was a tutor to other inmates, and meanwhile was looking at the possibility of serving the rest of his life in jail. And he was very fortunate in that he got a presidential commutation of sentence, and so his sentence was reduced to after he served about 20 years, and he was able to go home. But very few people get those kinds of commutations from the president. So he was an extraordinary case.
All right. The number to call to join the conversation on mandatory minimum sentences, is this something that you would support reforming? 614-8980. And let's go to the phones. John is standing by. John, welcome to The Source.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to ask the call lady there about restoration of rights. I know that a lot of people that have gone through the justice system often feel disenfranchised because they've lost their rights in some states to vote, in other states. Texas, for example, is a big gun state. If someone's been convicted of a nonviolent felony, why can't they get their rights restored? And I'd like to find out what the caller thinks about that, if that might be some consideration for the mandatory minimum reductions as well.
All right, John, thank you for your question. We'll see if Molly Gill from FAM, Families Against Mandatory Minimums, can address that. Molly.
Well, you raise a great point. All 50 states, it sort of depends on where you were convicted. If you were convicted in a state court, you need to talk with your state government about getting your gun rights restored. At the federal level, if you were convicted in a federal court, the only way you can get your gun rights back is to get a presidential pardon, which they're incredibly rare. President Obama has only granted about 30, I think the number's 39 in the last 5 or 6 years. So, you know, there it can be very difficult to get your rights restored. And that is just one of the many consequences of having a criminal conviction and why it's so important for us to really be careful when we decide what's a crime and what's going to carry a criminal record on someone's life for the rest of their lives, usually.
All right. Thank you for the question, John. And so let me ask you, is this hug a thug? Are we just trying to be nicer to our criminals so that they try and, you know, what about that criticism?
Absolutely not. You know, we're not against punishment. I used to assist in prosecuting crimes, and there are lots of scary, violent, dangerous people who need to be behind bars. And, you know, it's about public safety, and it's about using the limited resources we have in a wise and effective way. And mandatory minimum sentences are probably the bluntest instrument in a toolbox of all the possible options that we could use. The fact that we have so many for drug offenses, and we have locked up half of the federal prison population is serving time for a drug offense. And a lot of them are nonviolent, and a lot of them have addiction problems that really what they need is treatment. They need some supervision in the community and from the court. And Texas has been leading the nation in creating some of these alternatives to incarceration for drug offenders.
Okay, Molly.
So it's not that nobody. Go ahead.
I'm going to go ahead and move to another caller. Juan has been waiting. Okay. Juan wants to join the conversation. Juan, you're on the source.
Yes. I've been in state prison before in Texas, and Texas gives you these outrageous sentences. I'm a nonviolent offender, heroin addict. The last time I was in prison, I received 35 years, which I did 16. And once I got out, I was the same person as when I went in. These long sentences serve no purposes. Currently, my son is in federal prison under the minimum sentence. First offender, never been in any problems, got involved with the wrong people on a conspiracy charge. 17 years, which he will do 15 of them. So basically, his life is wasted. And it's the prosecutors where they do whatever is necessary to take all authority from the judges, when the judges are the ones that are supposed to be sentencing you. But because of the mandatory minimums, the judge has very little authority to do anything. Even if he sees a first offender, he cannot come down on his sentence. So they just, there is no purpose in them.
All right, Juan, thank you for your call. I really am sorry about your son, and I'm glad, hopefully, that you're doing a lot better now. So Molly Gill, when you hear Juan's story, does that sound familiar to you?
Sadly, it sounds all too familiar, and I'm very sorry to hear his son's situation, but sadly, there are tens of thousands of other people who have gone through what he's going through and will continue to do so unless we make changes.
We've heard so much about the prison industry in America, and prisons are being privatized. And are they opposed to the reform of mandatory minimums?
Well, it's It's hard to say. I think at some level there might be some truth to that. You know, on the other hand, I think there are always going to be people who break the law and people who go to prison, and I just don't see that being a real threat to that industry, if that's what we want to call it. So I think to the extent that those companies are touting those fears, I think they're probably overstated fears.
Now, we do have some legislation that has caught some attention in Washington, D.C. Patrick Leahy is also gotten some support from Rand Paul, teaming up together to try and reform mandatory minimums. Is this getting traction?
It is. The bill you're referring to is called the Justice Safety Valve Act. Senators Paul and Leahy introduced it in the Senate. On the House side, we've got an identical bill that was introduced by Representative Bobby Scott from Virginia and Thomas Massey, a Republican from Kentucky. And, you know, we're seeing some conservative voices come out and support this bill. And essentially what the bill does is it would allow judges to go below the mandatory minimum sentence in the federal system when the facts of the case warrant it, when the mandatory minimum is too long, when it's unnecessary to keep the public safe, if it's just not going to fit the offender and the crime. And this kind of reform is long overdue, and we are seeing some support for it and hearing more and more people start to talk about the need for it and the need to change our tactics, because at the federal level, we're really starting to see in the Department of Justice that they're just is not enough money to keep sinking all this money into sending these drug offenders to prison for this long.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Molly Gill. She is the Government's Affairs Counsel for Families Against Mandatory Minimums, or FAM. And we're talking about a current movement in America to reform mandatory minimums. Apparently, this is catching on in Washington, D.C., and something may happen in this area. This is The Source on KSTX. We'll be right back after the NPR news. We're going to talk about America's energy future.